as they were searching the property, they found some big barrels and behind a shed, and tarps pulled over them. So they pulled them out, and all of a sudden, and it's kind of disgusting, but when they pulled them out, flies went straight to the barrels.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. In this episode, we're going to hear updates on multiple serial killer cases. The Keith Gibson case in Philadelphia, the Gilgo Beach Killer case in New York, and the Slave Master case out of the Midwest. That voice you heard at the top of the show belongs to retired Detective Greg Wilson from Overland Park, Kansas, who recently did a deep dive interview into the Slave Master case with Dana Wright of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City. That interview followed Kansas Governor Laura Kelly's decision to deny the convicted killer's request for clemency. Before we get to those serial killer case updates, we'll cover developing crime stories and updates on several cases reported by Odyssey newsrooms this month. These include jury selection in the Topps mass shooting case out of Buffalo, New York, and the latest regarding Luigi Mangione's trials. Our first story was reported by Odyssey station WWJ News Radio in Detroit on June 4th.
It's a strange case unfolding downriver. Police looking for a man who allegedly lived in a motel room with his girlfriend's body for days before she was found dead. WWJ's Charlie Langton joining us live with more. Charlie.
I tell you what, Jackie, police need the public's help right now in this very bizarre story. Last week, a worker at the Red Roof Inn in Taylor discovered an abandoned room. In there, there was trash all over, two dogs, and the dead body of a woman. Now, police now say that her boyfriend, Christopher Schoonmaker, had been living in that Red Roof Inn with his dead girlfriend for days. The woman, Rebecca Pentnoid, showed no signs of foul play after an autopsy was conducted, although authorities are still waiting for the toxicology results. The boyfriend, however, took off with his girlfriend's credit cards. And if you have any information about the boyfriend or anything regarding this case, call the Taylor Police.
As of this Friday, police were still searching for the suspect. On June 8th, Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles reported on a tragedy that unfolded in Canoga Park, an area of the city located in the San Fernando Valley.
In front of an apartment complex on Owens Mouth, right across from Lanark Park, we're just north of Strathern. People have been coming by, leaving flowers, teddy bears.
Can't imagine somebody doing that to their own family, and the mom and the family, I can't imagine.
This woman, named Danica, brought two bunnies, one each for the 10-year-old boys, twins, who were murdered by their father, who shot and killed himself.
I don't know if anybody's ever known twins, but it's a very special bond that twins have, you know, so all I know is that they're with God or the Creator.
Neighbors say there may have been some sort of party going on. The mother told police she heard two pops, went into the bedroom to see what was going on. The father pointed the gun at her, shot but missed, then shot and killed himself. The motive is still unclear. In Canoga Park, I'm Emily Valdez, KNX News.
This week, KNX also reported on another disturbing story out of Canoga Park. A police officer there allegedly fatally shot a family's dog during a celebration for the New York Knicks Super Bowl win. The incident was captured on body camera footage that was released by police this Friday. In Chicago, Odyssey station WBBM News Radio reported on a deadly incident at an Amazon warehouse earlier this month.
20-year-old Quentin S. Williams Jr. has been charged with one count of first-degree murder. Melrose Park police say on June 4th, Travion R. Taylor of Chicago was in the parking garage with an Amazon co-worker who was arguing with Williams when Williams pulled out a semi-automatic rifle and fired several shots. Police say Taylor was shot in his back and later died at a hospital. A judge on Monday ordered Williams held in jail pending his trial. Roger Plummer, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
This next report from Odyssey station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia has the potential to impact a murder case from the 1980s.
A former top supervisor within the Philadelphia DA's office has been suspended from practicing in federal court for 3 years, accused of lying to a judge in order to overturn a death penalty sentence. More now from KYW's crime and justice reporter, Kristen Johansson.
The federal court unsealed the order to suspend Nancy Winkleman, a former supervisor in the district attorney's law division, earlier this week. A panel of three judges agreed the longtime attorney should be suspended because they say she misrepresented critical facts in order to vacate a defendant's sentence. It comes several months after her subordinate, Paul George, was disbarred from federal court for the same reason and the same case, which involves Robert Wharton, a man convicted of murdering a Mount Airy couple in the 80s. After exhausting all of his appeals at the state level, Wharton turned to the federal court to vacate his sentence, and the DA's office sided with him. The judges say George didn't investigate or properly vet the case before siding with the defendant, and he didn't notify the family, specifically that baby girl. They say Winkleman didn't review any of what was presented to the judge, but signed off on it anyway. In a report, the judges write, quote, "We further find that she was willfully blind to and complicit in George's misrepresentations." Earlier this week, a state court directed the state's attorney general to review cases the DA's office wants to overturn, accusing the DA of misrepresenting facts.
Now we'll hear the latest on the trial for Peyton Gendron, who is accused of killing 10 people in a racially motivated mass shooting at a top supermarket in Buffalo, New York, a little over 4 years ago. Attorney John Elmore, who represents survivors and families of the shooting's victims, joined Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo this week to discuss jury selection for Gendron's trial.
The jury selection process is underway in the federal trial of the Topps mass shooter. John, we know 1,200 questionnaires went out to prospective jurors. What are we seeing now this week in federal court?
Well, what's happening is that these jurors have received questionnaires. The purpose of the questionnaires is to find out whether or not a person is fit to serve in a death penalty case. A death penalty case is unusual because the jury determines the sentence of the defendant if he is found guilty. So the jury selection process in a death penalty case is much different. In most criminal trials, jurors don't get questionnaires. In most criminal trials as well as civil trials, the jury selection process lasts 1 or 2 days. But because this is a death penalty case, death is different. The jury selection process is very complicated. All of the jurors are filling out questionnaires. Eventually, those questionnaires will be distributed to the lawyers. Once they're distributed to the lawyers will exercise what's known as challenges for cause, which means that if for a legal reason a jury is unfit to serve, then they would be not called into court to be questioned individually. A prospective juror that believes that death should be automatic sentence, if somebody is convicted of a death-eligible crime, they cannot serve. If somebody believes that under no circumstances would they vote for the death penalty, they cannot serve. And you have to think about it. It's a very difficult decision that, you know, you're putting in a citizen's hands to determine whether or not a person lives and dies. So this process is going to, the questionnaire process is going to last for a long time. And then eventually the jurors are going to be brought into the courtroom to be questioned individually, not only about their views of the death penalty, but just a lot of questions about their backgrounds, their feelings about our criminal justice system, what's going to happen is again, if they get challenged for cause and can't serve because of their views on the death penalty, or maybe other views that it could be a hardship, family hardship, the inability to miss work or anything like that, or just a certain bias. It could be racial bias. It could be animosity towards police or law enforcement or whatever that would make them unfair or unfit. Then the judge will strike them. Then after that, each side will have the opportunity to exercise what's known as peremptory challenges. In a federal death penalty case, the prosecution and the defense have what's known as peremptory challenges, 20, and they can just use those challenges to exercise for a potential juror that they just do not feel fits the profile that they want to have in this case.
Well, it sounds like a lot of people who might not be qualified. Is it going to be tough to see the jury?
It is going to be very, very difficult. 1,200 questionnaires is a lot. You know, normally in a criminal case, you know, they may call 30, 40, 50, 60 potential jurors and then eventually get it whittled down to 12 to hear the case and one or two alternates. But in a death penalty case, because, this is the ultimate decision that anybody could make in their lifetime, whether or not somebody lives or dies. And not only that, but this is going to be a long, complicated trial. You know, most trials are over in 4, 5, 6 days. Not only is this trial expected to be very lengthy, but, you know, it'll probably last over a month. And in a death penalty case, there's two trials. One is to determine whether or not the person is guilty of a death-eligible crime. And then if the 12 jurors agree on that, then there's a second phase where they get instructed about what their role is in determining whether or not death is the appropriate sentence, and then the lawyers then try a case all over again where the defense puts on mitigating evidence and the prosecution argues against the mitigating evidence, and then the jury is given instructions again, and then they go and deliberate again about the sentence. So it's a long sacrifice when you think about it. Who can just take 2 months of their life, maybe even a longer, and come into a courtroom in Buffalo, New York, and listen to testimony, 6-7 hours a day, and then go home and to try and live a normal life.
Trials for Luigi Mangione, the accused killer of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, are also impending. This week, Mangione's legal team made a surprise move. Let's hear about it from Taylor Rivera out of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities.
A judge in New York this morning announcing that Luigi Mangione will assert a psychiatric defense at his state murder trial. Mangione's lawyers will attempt to show that he was suffering from extreme emotional disturbance at the time of the shooting on a Midtown sidewalk. If successful, Mangione could be sent to a psychiatric treatment facility rather than prison. The announcement in open court this morning may explain the unusual closed-door hearing the judge held 2 weeks ago and the sealing of the transcript. Because Mangione is facing federal charges as well, his attorneys argue that what was discussed behind closed doors could impact his federal case. Taylor Rivera, News Talk 830, WCCO.
Adam Carter of WCCO News Talk discussed what this change in the Mangione case really means with Jack Rice, a defense attorney.
Explain this defense of extreme emotional disturbance. Is this somewhat similar to an insanity defense, or how is this different?
Absolutely. It is similar to an insanity defense. Think about it like this. If you think that for a moment I lost my mind, right, that, and you're arguing that temporary insanity, if you will, that and the example that people have used in the past is if a spouse walked in on another spouse that was cheating, they've killed them and they've claimed, oh, my gosh, I just lost my mind for a moment. And that's how people might argue this. In New York, it's not technically an insanity defense because if you're convicted of it based upon this extreme emotional disturbance, it actually, you're still convicted, you'd still get sent to prison, but it would be at a lower level. Instead of a second degree murder, it would be a first degree manslaughter charge, which is a much less sentence. So it's a little bit different, but kind of the same. But you know what? In the end, the real problem that Mangione has is that they have video of him, they have the gun, they have a book that describes everything that was going to happen. The state has lined up a ton of stuff here.
Yeah, and the alleged writings he put on the bullets. I mean, that certainly doesn't seem like that was a spur-of-the-moment thing.
Yeah, see, that's the real problem here, is that technically, when you look at all these things, you're going to have to make the argument that not only was he just walking down the street and walked into the room like, you know, the spouse kind of thing, this has to be the whole buildup, and I think you just put your finger on it. That's the difference. You got to go back and say, I lost my mind not just for the moment when I'm walking down a New York City street. It's the whole buildup unto it.
ABC reporter Peter Haralambos joined WBEN for some more insight into the emotional disturbance defense and why Mangione's unusual popularity for an accused killer might be one of the reasons why his legal team has chosen this path.
Can you help us understand what went on in the courtroom and what his lawyers might be looking to do?
Yeah, good morning. It's really a dramatic change for Mangione's defense. After spending 18 months basically arguing that Luigi Mangione was not the person who gunned down UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, his lawyers yesterday acknowledged that they're changing strategy. They're thinking about using what's called an emotional disturbance event defense. It's a New York-specific defense where they might basically just argue that in that moment of the alleged crime, he was undergoing an extreme emotional episode, and that because of that, he basically lost control of himself. The goal there is basically to drop this case from murder, which carries a possibility of life in prison, to manslaughter, which only carries a maximum of 25 years. They're basically just trying to argue that, yes, potentially he was the guy who did this crime, but because of these emotions, because of the psychiatric episode, he lacked the intentionality, the willfulness needed to prove murder as a crime.
I think a lot of people, when they heard this yesterday, thought, oh, it's an insanity defense, but an extreme emotional defense is different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're talking about two related but different things. If you're using an insanity defense, the outcome there is that, you know, even if you're found not guilty, you'll be committed to a psychiatric institution. The emotional disturbance defense, this New York-specific defense, is much narrower. Rather than trying to say outright he's necessarily, they're trying to knock this down from murder to manslaughter and basically say he was not culpable for the specifics of that crime. That being said, he's not trying to say outright that, you know, he's totally insane, that he's lost his control of himself and what's going on in the world. They're still going to present him as, you know, a cogent person who just at the time of the alleged crime, about 2 years ago, was going through an episode that was outside of his control. We'll have to learn over time what exactly they're going to argue that episode was. Eventually, they're going to have to unseal all of these records about this defense and potentially reveal some of his psychiatric records as well.
It's a different thing that we're used to seeing. How do you go about proving this? And does it have to be a, you know, when you mentioned a strong emotion, I'm picturing in my head, you know, like a moment, something that would, you know, happen in the snap of your fingers or the blink of an eye, maybe not something that was planned out ahead of time. But does that necessarily have to be the case?
Yeah, that's what's going to get tricky, because prosecutors have pointed to this, you know, evidence of premeditation, the fact that, you know, he was planning this out for a while, that we're talking about, you know, weeks here, detailed plans about how he was going to do this, how he was going to escape the city. And this defense is usually reserved for a much shorter episode. Think of an example of someone walking in on their partner having an affair, and then in the heat of the moment, killing the person the partner was having an affair with. Really a split second in which emotions take over and remove a person's basically control of themselves. That's kind of the argument they're using here in the case of the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. And in the case of Luigi Mangione, he's, you know, spending someone who spent, based on the evidence we've seen thus far, at least a few weeks planning this out. So it's going to be complicated. Under New York State penal law, there's a three-pronged test they need to prove to get this defense over the line. They need to prove that he was undergoing an episode that basically prompted him to totally lose control. control, that the reason for that emotional episode was reasonable, that you know, if you consider his circumstances, the fact that he was going through this was kind of beyond his control, and then last, that psychotic episode actually was invoked at the time of the alleged crime. So if they're able to succeed with that three-part test, they could theoretically reduce the amount of prison time he faces significantly.
I'm wondering, Peter, based on the legal experts that you talk with, is this viewed as a long shot defense or a realistic path for this team?
Yes. So far, based on the conversations I've had, legal experts have basically said that this is potentially a win-win for Mangione's legal defense, in that you know, they were dealt a pretty poor hand earlier this year, where a judge basically ruled that some of the strongest evidence against Mangione, including the alleged murder weapon, writings that prosecutors say amount to a confession, could be used at trial. Since that really, really tough ruling for them, this new defense really opens some doors for them. It creates the possibility that this sentence is reduced down to about a maximum of 25 years. And according to one legal expert I spoke to, it could also present a backdoor to jury nullification. The idea being that in describing why this emotional episode was reasonable, it could provide defense attorneys time to basically explain Mangione's grievances with the healthcare system. In doing so, it could be basically invite the jurors to talk about kind of the ethics behind this, their grievances with the healthcare system, and potentially convince one or two jurors to acquit, even if though the evidence overwhelmingly shows guilt. That's illegal. Jury nullification is not allowed. But this defense, you know, at the end of the day, jury nullification is not allowed by law in New York State or anywhere. You can't just tell a jury to basically find someone not guilty because they think the crime they did was justified. But by describing why they think Mangione's alleged emotional episode was reasonable, his grievances potentially with the healthcare system, it could basically open up a window for these lawyers to say, you know, here's why he was so angry, here's why he had this episode, and maybe find a few sympathetic jurors who agree and have similar grievances with the healthcare system. So we'll have to see.
However, Brad Young, an attorney and legal expert who joined the Dave Glover Show out of Odyssey Station KMOX in St. Louis this week, said it's a pretty risky move.
He's stating that he was acting under extreme emotional disturbance. That's his defense, right? Mm-hmm. So if he wins on that argument, then the jury still finds him guilty, but he gets a lesser charge. But here's why this is, I think, very dangerous legally. To exercise that defense that you were acting under an extreme emotional disturbance when you killed Brian Thompson, the CEO of United Healthcare, at that point, he has to admit that he did it. He has to actually admit that he shot and killed the guy. And he's saying, yeah, but I did it because I was under extreme emotional disturbance. So now all of a sudden the prosecution doesn't even have to prove you did it. They're going to admit that they did it. And to me, boy, that's a Hail Mary. I mean, either you win it big or you lose it big. But I think that's a dangerous defense.
In this section of the show, we're looking into several serial killer cases. Our first case is from Odyssey Station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia. There, Keith Gibson, who called himself the Beast, was on trial for four murders committed between January and June of 2021. KYW reported on June 9th that
a Philadelphia jury has convicted Keith Gibson of murder in the shooting deaths of four people in 2021, including his own mother. KYW Crime and Justice reporter Kristen Johansson says there's finally relief for the victims' families.
Keith Gibson was found guilty of first-degree murder in the shooting deaths of Roy Caban, Eric Flores, Christine Lugo, and his own mother, Christine Gibson. The families for both Lugo and Christine Gibson say it's been a long 5 years.
The first day for the rest of our lives, and we can move on. Now we can work on just healing and praising God for this day.
It's not good because it's never going to feel good, but at least someone else finally got to make some decisions on his fate.
The defendant was immediately sentenced to four life sentences plus 38 to 76 years for additional robbery and gun convictions. Prosecutor Katie Wood.
These four individuals especially were hardworking individuals, good everyday citizens here in Philadelphia whose lives were taken just so senselessly.
Wood also credits Gibson's former friend for coming forward and identifying him after seeing pictures connected to Lugo's killing.
The defendant said he was sorry for the families, but then told the judge he's filing an immediate appeal in the case.
KYW also reported that during the trial,
the defense repeatedly told jurors Keith Gibson is innocent and never killed the four people he's accused of killing in 2021. And they said police just needed to close cold cases and chose Gibson as their suspect. They tried to poke holes in the prosecution's case, questioning why detectives didn't try to test certain pieces of evidence for DNA and why they didn't get surveillance video of the suspect at two of the crime scenes. Gibson is charged with four counts of first-degree murder for store clerks Eric Flores and Roy Caban, his own mother, Christine Gibson, and Dunkin' Donuts store manager Christine Lugo. Prosecutors have said all were shot in the head with the same gun and the motive was money. They say they can tie Gibson to all of the killings. Gibson chose not to testify and has been watching from another room in the courthouse because he didn't want to be shackled.
Rex Huerman's murders in Long Island, New York have haunted families there for decades. This week, the Gilgo Beach killer case finally closed. Here's the report from Odyssey station 1010 Winds in New York.
The Gilgo Beach serial killer got his sentence today. He will never see the light of day outside prison for the rest of his life for all those murders he committed and for the impact his crimes have had on the victims' relatives, many of whom showed up in court today to tell him face to face what he did to their lives. Sophia Hall has covered this case from day one, folks, keeping us up to speed on every aspect of it. And now she closes the books, unless something else comes up to lead our broadcast.
Family members cried in the courtroom. One demanded that Rex Huerman look at her. The admitted serial killer did for a second and then looked away. He never appeared to glance in the direction of the victim's family members, even as 10 of them addressed the court. They called him cowardly, a demon. A daughter of one of the victims said, quote, "As a little girl, I needed my mother." When the judge sentenced Huerman to life without the possibility of parole and said, "Get him out of here," the family members of the victim stood up and cheered. Sophia Hall, 1010 Winds, on 92.3 FM on Long Island.
And for the first time in a long time, if ever, we actually heard Rex Huerman's voice as he spoke during the sentencing.
Rex Huerman showed zero emotion, even when he spoke, only to say there was nothing to say.
There are no words I can say. I am responsible for what was said in this room.
He then said his words have no meaning. He spoke so softly that someone yelled for him to speak up, but he was already finished. Judge Timothy Mazie was not.
I know that you're sorry that you got caught. I assume that you're sorry for what you've done to your wife and children. Are you a little bit sorry for what you did to these poor innocent women?
Huerman answered, "Yes, I am," before the judge read the sentencing and said,
"Get him out of here."
Mac Rosenberg, 1010 Winds on 92.3 FM.
Wow. Meantime, Huerman's ex-wife continues her battle to have her charges against her dropped, saying she had no idea what he was doing and played no part in it, and says the civil case against her then has no place.
Winds also covered the reactions from people still mourning the killer's victims.
Rex Huerman was sent to prison for the rest of his life by an angry judge following an emotional court proceeding.
The children of the victims of serial killer Rex Huerman spoke about the pain of growing up without a mother.
The first time I remember experiencing depression in my life was my first Christmas without her.
I never had her when I needed her, and I will never have her in the future when I need her.
Some of the family members loudly spoke to Rex while looking at him, but he never looked at them.
She never picked up the phone. She didn't call anyone back because of you.
For others, it's been decades. The pain, however, is still very raw.
I lived with survivor's guilt for over a decade.
10 family members of the victims spoke in court. Sophia Hall, 1010 Winds, on 92.3 FM on Long Island.
Huerman pleaded guilty this past April to strangling 8 women, then dismembering their remains and disposing them in remote areas around Long Island, including Gilgo Beach. He was given that life sentence with no possibility of parole after making a brief statement that included the words, quote, "I am responsible."
According to reports, the Gilgo Beach killer had a, quote, kill room in his Massapequa Park home where he would torture his victims. His family was reportedly planning to move out of the home as of 2024. While some homes where horrific crimes have occurred have been demolished, others stay standing. The Dana and Parks show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City, featuring Dana Wright, Scott Parks, and Sam Stevie III, recently covered one such situation in their city.
For some reason, the home of a notorious serial killer was never knocked down. And when I tell you what he did, you will not understand why. The home is now for sale in Long Island. There is a home for sale listing on Long Island that now stands out as the location of, oh my God, 17 brutal murders. The home is where serial killer Joel Rifkin killed and dismembered. Yeah, they made fun of him in Seinfeld.
Really?
He was in a Seinfeld episode where he killed and dismembered many of his 17 victims, is now listed for sale for just under $800,000. According to Zillow, the property's price tag is in line with some neighboring houses. The home's listing describes it as a beautiful, expanded cape that was built in 1951. I don't know, where people were slaughtered and tortured between 1989 and 1993. Why would they not knock down a house like that?
He's still alive. He's 67.
Why would they keep that house intact after 17 people were killed there?
What do you want them to do?
You would knock it down like they did the Bordella house here.
Who would knock it down?
Anyone. I can't believe that would even be bought and sold once, let alone however many times since you went away.
Would you buy the property, tear down the house, and then build a new house on top of it? That doesn't take away.
They knocked down Deborah Green's house in Prairie Village, and it's just green space.
Bingo. So who's going to buy the property? Nobody ever built on Deborah Green's property.
Who's going to buy an $800,000 house where 17 people were slaughtered, dismembered, and then what? You're going to have people driving by and pointing.
Honest to God, I'd never heard of Joel Rifkin before you just mentioned his name.
I think it's because we're not on the East Coast, and I'm 100% certain he was in a Seinfeld episode. Because someone shared that name, and when they, you know, said it over the loudspeaker, Elaine looked around and she goes, oh my gosh, he is notorious maybe in that part of the country.
He may have killed them on the property, but he did not bury them there.
Well, I don't care. Well, who would live in a house like that? And do you have to disclose that? You should have to disclose that. Oh, listen, it says it's well-maintained.
Well, they got the blood out.
It's a well-maintained home offering a spacious and versatile layout with sun-filled living areas. The sun, you know, that thing that no one else ever saw when they went into the house back in the 90s.
By the way, Elaine's boyfriend was named
Rifkin.
Yep.
Was it Remy Rifkin?
Nope, Joel.
Ugh.
They named a character on the show?
Yep.
Joel Rifkin?
I think that was part of the skit.
Specifically because the serial killer, Joel Rifkin. And they would call his name, and Elaine would be let's not call him that. Oh, we don't have to say that out loud. By the way, there is an updated Eden kitchen, generous-sized bedrooms, and plenty of storage throughout.
The Dana and Parks show also covered the latest update to a decades-long serial killer case in the Midwest this week. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly denied a clemency request from the, quote, slave master killer John Robinson, named after his online persona.
She issued the following statement today, announcing the denial of clemency for one of the most evil human beings that this area has ever known. Convicted serial killer John Robinson apparently had the gall to ask for clemency from the governor, which I don't even know where to begin with this because it's so ridiculous on his face that this would even come up, but he asked, and the governor today replied. Kansas reinstated the death penalty in 1994. It remains the law today. The state constitution vests the governor with the ability to commute sentences following a statutory mandated process. The governor goes on to say, as the existence of a credible claim of innocence or evidence of manifest injustice are absent in his request, I have denied John Robinson's request to commute his death sentence. And I imagine the governor with two beautiful, gigantic middle fingers up in the air with respect to this case. And she's way too diplomatic and lovely and good at her job to do that. So she released that lovely statement. The fact that he even asked is a joke.
Yeah. Again, if I were in her shoes, the response would have been a total of six letters, a four-letter word and a two-letter word.
Yep.
And that would have been it.
Retired Overland Park Detective Greg Wilson joined the show Thursday for a deep dive into the Robinson case and the lasting impact of the investigation into it.
I'm going to get to our guest now because I will remind you, this is an investigation, oh my goodness, that involved Overland Park, the FBI, the Social Security Department, Lenexa, the Johnson County Sheriff's Department, Missouri law enforcement officials, the District Attorney's Office, after the murder and torture of at least eight women between 1985 and 2000. And immediately this morning when I saw the news that death sentence request has been denied, I reached out to retired Detective Greg Wilson, who we worked with extensively when I was at Channel 5 on this case. I can't decide if the media was your friend at that point, Greg, or your foe. You spent 37 years at Overland Park before retiring. And Dan and I were talking about this, Greg. I still remember the day we were down there in Lacine. We knew something had happened. We didn't know what. I don't even think detectives, correct me if I'm wrong, knew what you were in for when you first started hearing that something might be amiss down there.
No, we didn't. Not at all.
What led you to Lacine? Take us back.
So when this all kind of started to fall together for us, one of the Lenexa detectives, we started following Robinson. One of the Lenexa detectives happened to start following him one day. I think there's actually two or three of them. And they followed him all the way down to Lacine. And they followed him to this location. And
why were they following him?
Because we, at that point in time, we had started our investigation. And so we wanted to see what his movements were. We wanted to see if, and to back up a little bit, it all, our, what got us, our interest peaked in him was that there was a missing person that was reported out of Michigan. So it had been reported to Overland Park. Overland Park looked at it. We, this is Lenexa's jurisdiction.
Yeah. And the tip said what? Remind everybody that there's this woman who left Michigan. She came to Kansas, met some guy named John. We don't know where she went.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And then, so it was Suzette Troughton.
Yeah.
And she was really big into the computer communications with friends, family, and all that. And there were certain things that clued them off in Michigan that something wasn't right, because I guess she was very consistent in contacting her mom several times a day. And then there were some other things that happened. And I'm trying to abbreviate because the story
Something was just off.
Yes.
In her writing. In
yes.
Her, yeah.
So her mother contacted us, and she actually had gotten bounced around a couple of different agencies before it landed on us. Now, what's kind of interesting about this is that the officer that took the report said this is the Lenexa's jurisdiction, and so he took it to our sergeant. The sergeant, Marty Ingram at the time, looked at it, and he said, I know this guy because I arrested him a long time ago for fraud when he was a detective, when Marty was a detective. So he took it to the watch commander and said, this is significant. We know this guy. He's got a history with us, but it's not our jurisdiction. So they contacted our investigations division. The watch commander did, patrol did. The next morning when I came in, my sergeant, Joe Reed, he said, hey, come in here And to back up a little bit, I had been sent to a class in, it was in Oklahoma City about 6 months prior, and it was missing and exploited children investigations. One of the investigations that was highlighted in it was Tiffany Stassi. And he said, you're going to get questions about this because they're listed in the National Center.
Wow.
Her and her mother. I'm like, okay. So he said, make yourself familiar in case they ask questions.
Just in case. Because at this point, you knew there was one missing woman.
Yes.
That might be tied to him. You had no idea how far this was going to go.
Correct. So I still had the case file on my desk. And, you know, I'd been looking at it periodically. And so I looked at the report from the night before, and I said, well, Joe, this is Lenexa's jurisdiction. And he said, well, go check and make sure, because it's right on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, it was. And I asked the clerk, and they said that the clerk said she had checked out, but John Robinson was the guy that was paying the bills. And
she had checked out of where?
Out of the – it was an extended stay.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one paying the bills, and he'd come in to clean the room out apparently one day. I think it was a day prior to me getting there, and I asked if they had any surveillance video or anything. And there he was, paying the bill and very recognizable.
Oh, yeah. He looks like a grandfather now.
Oh, yeah. Well, he looked like a grandfather then.
Little, chubby, mm-hmm. smiling.
Yep.
Right? And yes. What did you find in the extended stay room? Anything of note?
So at that point in time, we contacted Lenexa police and we gave them the case. Lenexa took it from there. They started working on it. And I think the next day, maybe, they contacted us and said this could be a little bit more manpower or person power intensive. And are you guys able to help? So that's how we got involved.
So pretty early on, there was some fear that this was bigger than just one missing woman.
Yeah, because we had made two or three other missing person reports back in the 80s. Before I'd even gotten hired with Overland Park. And it was Catherine Clampett, Lisa Stassi, and I'm sorry, I forgot the third person.
Can you remind everyone in the Lisa Stassi case, she is the young woman who went missing with her baby.
Yes.
And that baby ended up where?
we didn't find her. Her parents in Chicago, her adoptive parents in Chicago, contacted the FBI when they heard about this whole big investigation happening in Kansas.
And said, we're worried this baby
is Lisa.
The child.
The child.
We've never named her the child.
Yeah.
And Lisa has never been found. Is that accurate?
Correct.
One of the questions I have as we move forward, and then I want you to take us to Lacine, is do you think there will ever come a time where you will truly know in Lenexa or the FBI or Kansas City or wherever how many women there really are? There's no way it's just eight. And that the eight and the stories with all of those women are so devastating to their families. There has to be more.
I think everybody that was involved in the case believes there's probably more. And so, for example, one of the ladies that we found from out in the Raymore storage shed, she came from Colorado. He literally had met her online, told her he would have her move to Kansas City with him.
Yeah, I've got a job for you.
Well, he went out overnight, picked her up and her child, and drove them back, and nobody knew. I mean, nobody. Even her friends, they knew that they had lost touch, but they
didn't
had no
know
clue.
Where she went or why, and would never have heard of this guy named John in Kansas.
Correct.
The victims are Suzette Troughton, 27 years old, Isabella Lueco, who was 21, Sheila Faith, 45, and her 15-year-old daughter, one of them disabled.
Yeah. So it was Sheila who came from Colorado, and it was her daughter, Debbie, and she was in a wheelchair.
49-year-old Beverly Bonner and 19-year-old Lisa Stassi, who disappeared along with her 4-month-old daughter, who was eventually adopted. in a scam adoption by John Robinson's brother. We have Paula Godfrey. We have Catherine Clampett, Teresa Williams. And then due to Robinson's history of fraud, embezzlement, and manipulation of vulnerable women, authorities have long suspected he may be responsible for other unsolved disappearances. So John Robinson's conviction followed the longest criminal trial in the history of the state of Kansas. He was convicted in 2002. We had to look this up. The arrest came June 2nd, 2000, and started with the city of Lenexa and the city of Overland Park looking for a young woman by the name of Suzette Troughton, who had gone missing from Michigan. And you said this earlier, Greg, off the air. Her mother said to you, if you find her two beloved dogs without her, it will confirm that something is very, very wrong.
Yes.
And you found the dogs.
Yes. I didn't, but the investigators did, yeah.
So what was it that drew you? You are now following him. You think he's linked to the disappearance of this one woman. What was it that drew you to the property in Lacine? And you were there that day.
So, like I had said previously, the Lenexa detectives had started following him pretty closely after they realized that Suzette was missing, and she was connected to him. And then we connected the dots in the respect that back in the 80s, Overland Park had three missing women that were connected to him. And that's the information we passed on to Lenexa. So we knew it was a big deal. So that's why we started following Robinson.
And he led you guys, you said, to storage units all over town.
In Olathe, and then over in...
Raymore
was one. Yeah, I think that was the other one that we saw or went to.
That you didn't even know about.
No, we didn't. And so anyway, it was just, I don't mean to get off track. So we started following, Lenexa police started following them. They followed him out to Lacine and to this piece of property. And there was a trailer there. And he spent some time there at the trailer and then left. Well, we decided we needed to, that's a piece of property that we probably need to search out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And we've got a missing woman. So we got search warrants and we went out there. The day, apparently, it was a Saturday, and you probably went out there on a Sunday.
Absolutely, it was the next day.
So, yes, on Saturday, we got out there. We had search teams. There was a couple FBI agents with us.
Dogs.
Overland Park, we had cadaver dogs. We had Lenexa, and there probably were some other law enforcement agencies.
And at first, remind me, everyone's looking around, and you don't find, I mean, they're... Nothing, right? For a while.
Correct. So we split it up and we had different search teams for different areas. I was a scuba diver for Overland Park. So our dive team, we were searching. There was a pond there. Yeah. And so we were doing the pond search. And Lenexa officers, along with some Overland Park folks, as they were searching the property, they found some big barrels and behind a shed, and tarps pulled over them. So they pulled them out, and all of a sudden, and it's kind of disgusting, but when they pulled them out, flies went straight to the barrels. And when they opened the barrels, they found Isabella. And then they opened a second barrel, and they found the other girl, Suzette Troughton.
And you thought at that moment what?
You know, it was sad because we've got two dead people. There was some, you hate to say elation, but there was excitement because we knew we had him. Because I think anybody that had dealt with John Robinson over the years knew
he's a scam artist,
that he was a bad guy, but he was very good at hiding his tracks. And but we knew we had him then. And we just started building our case, and we started working. And that's the way we found the other women in Raymore. You just follow the evidence, and you follow the trail, and eventually it leads you to these things. And during the course of our investigation, we sent detectives out to many places across Kansas and Missouri We had FBI agents that contacted people. I think it was in Georgia or Alabama.
Yeah.
And there was people up in the Northwest, or ladies up in the Northwest, that he had made contact with, people in California. So we just kept following the clues, and we made a contact with a lot of people.
How many women were ultimately found on the Lacine property in the barrels?
So they're the two ladies in the barrels.
The two women.
Yes.
And then in the Raymore facility?
The Raymore facility were the three.
So that's five.
There's five.
Do we know where the other three victims remain today?
No. They were from the 80s. Yeah. That was Catherine Clampett. That was Lisa Stassi. And
why won't he just say?
Why would he?
He's a sociopath. We know that.
Yeah, he'll never admit it. And he thinks that he somehow is going to get out of jail. But he won't. I mean, unless there's some kind of act of God or something like that, or I don't know.
I don't think it's going to be an act of God.
No.
So it's interesting when you look at the impact this case had on other law enforcement agencies and investigative techniques, because you have to remember his arrest did not come until the very early 2000s. He had been kidnapping and murdering women much, much longer than that. And because of that, and the method he used, John Robinson is really recognized as one of the first murderers to use the internet for evil, to find his victims. How did he talk all of these women into coming here? Middle of nowhere. How?
Each one had their own story. And essentially, he would find them on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
He portrayed himself as a master in the BDSM world.
So he found them, like, I don't want to say the dark web, but he found them through that.
Yes.
And then consenting adults, whatever.
Yes.
And then promised what?
It depended. It just depended on what.
Wow.
He would find out what their weakness was or what their need was.
Yep.
For example, Sheila Faith and her daughter. Sheila's husband had passed away in California from cancer, I believe it was. She moved out to Colorado with her daughter, and I think it was because there was friends or family mm-hmm. closer there. And she was kind of dabbling in this BDSM world, and he met her on online. She gave him the backstory and this, that, and the other.
And her daughter was disabled, correct?
Disabled, correct. He said, well, you know, I'm tied in very closely with therapists, doctors, all these people that can, you know, we can help your daughter.
Can help her.
So he actually went out, moved him to the Kansas City metro area, and that's how he got him there.
For how long? Because he was married. He had children. So how long were the victims here wondering, where is the promise of this millionaire business guy that's going to help me before the disappearances?
Well, he always had the excuse that he was either a doctor or he was a traveling salesman. We found letters where he was telling one of the girls that he worked for the CIA and he was an assistant director.
Okay, yeah.
He said that he was sitting one time on the tarmac in an F-15, and he blew out tires on the, he was an F-15 pilot.
Right.
Blew out tires on the F-15.
Wasn't he like 300 pounds? I mean,
probably
250. I'm going to go with, you're not an F-15 pilot, John.
No, but it was just, you know, when I read the text messages.
Yeah.
I got embarrassed just by reading the crap he was writing.
But preying on women who he is meeting the need.
Yes.
And we see this with our elderly victims when it comes to scams. Greg, you know this.
Yes.
They're lonely.
Yep.
They think this is the ticket and the answer.
Yep.
They need services for their child. Like, all of those things brought those women here. And if he wasn't so good at it in a really awful way, and I don't mean that to be complimentary, all of the women wouldn't have followed him here. He was very good at what he did.
It's true.
Tell me about the letters, how the families wondered something doesn't feel right here. Didn't he have them sign their names?
So, for example, Suzette, her mother told us this, that she didn't spell very well. her grammatically. She didn't do well. But she was getting letters from, the mother was getting letters from her daughter.
Oh, they were brilliantly written, weren't
they? And they're brilliantly written. And just the kind of the prose, the way that they were worded and things like that.
You know how your child talks.
Yes, exactly. And she said, this is not my daughter writing this. And kind of the same thing with the other people. Beverly Bonner, she met him when he was in the penitentiary in Missouri from the 80s crimes that he had been arrested for. And it was fraud, theft and fraud. And she was a librarian there.
That's right. She was the prison librarian.
Her husband was the penitentiary doctor. So when he got out, he had started a relationship with her in the penitentiary. And I had to go to Missouri and interview one of the guys that had been in prison with him. And he was having an affair with her while they were in the penitentiary. And then when he got released, he talked her into moving in with him, said that they were going to travel Europe.
Right. Where was his wife when all this was going on? One of the hardest things for people to believe is that it's possible that all of this is going on over here, and somehow the woman with whom you are spending all of your time has no idea. And do you believe she had no idea?
I don't think that she knew what he was doing per se. I think that she knew that he was having a lot of affairs. And I know, we know that she at one time had said that she wanted a divorce. And we learned that from the day that we arrested him. And we had detectives pick her up right away.
What did she say when you picked her up?
Well, I was with Robinson. The detectives, you know, they said something about, you know, we want to talk to you about the women that John has been seeing. And she said, which ones? Because there's been so many. And they went into their discussion with her to see what they could pull out. And I really don't think that she had any clue about what he was doing with them. He was always on the road. He was down in Lacine working on this property that he was trying to get, you know, for their little weekend getaways fixed up and all that. So, you know, he had excuses for everything. Yeah. And I think that at some point in time, maybe she just got worn out with it. And I think that she probably was close to divorcing him.
Give me some information about the day of the arrest. What did that look like, and what was his reaction when it all kind of came crashing down?
So we went in there, knocked on the door, Jake and I did, Detective Boyer, said we were looking into some missing women, and we knew that he had this, you know, knew them and had been seen with them, and if could he ask us any or answer any questions for us. So we just sat down, and we just started chit-chatting, and he denied, obviously, knowing where they were. Then you throw out a few questions that you knew the answers to.
Yeah.
And so we tried to catch in some lies, which we did. And eventually it was just, you know, enough is enough. You're under arrest. And at that time it was for a felony warrant. But that gave us a chance to get in and do the search on his property because we already had search warrants.
So you had not found the women at that point?
Oh, no, no. This was the first day, really, of when everything started to break. We had, I think they said there was probably 50 cops that were in the area. We were wired so they could hear what was going on. We had Overland Park, Lenexa, FBI, they were all listening. And I remember when we walked out, one of the things that he said to many people was that he had had several strokes and he was partially paralyzed on his left side. And so as we were walking out, I was holding his arm. You know, we handcuffed him. I was holding his arm, walking him in the car. And I remember grabbing the man's arm, and it was solid as a rock. There was no paralysis there whatsoever. Then the detectives and the marked units and people like that started kind of showing up. And he said, Jesus, you're making a big deal out of nothing. And so we took him to the Lenexa Police Department where he was booked. he told us immediately, you know, I want my attorney. And, you know, we respected that, obviously. So he did talk to his attorney on the telephone. And while he was doing that, I told Detective Boyer, I said, hey, go up to the room and just lay out all the pictures of all the women. Because we had surveillance pictures for 3 months. And we knew all the women, or a lot of the women, that he had been contacting and stuff. On the board, there was a map to his property in Lacine. We had pictures of him. We had pictures of Suzette, all of that information. And I said, so we walked him upstairs, and I told him before we went in, I said, I just want you to know that we're going to respect your right to not talk to us, but I want you to know that we've made a project out of you for the last several months. And we opened the door and walked in, and he stood and he just looked at everything. And then on the table we had driver's license photos, but they were 8x10s. And he went to each one and just stopped and looked at them and paused for probably 15, 20 seconds on each woman. And then after we went back downstairs, he called his attorney, and they were talking again. And at that time, his bond, I think, was set at $250,000. And, you know, we're only hearing one side of the conversation. And he told his attorney, he says, yeah, $250,000 sounds a little high for a theft bond. And he said, but there's some pictures of women that I need to talk to you about. And that's really the last thing that, you know, he hung up and nothing else was said.
Was he ever sorry?
Oh, God, no. No, I don't think so. No, I think, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist or anybody like that. I think he's a sociopath. He just doesn't care who he hurts.
Sorry he got caught.
He's sorry he got caught. And he had gotten caught so many times. He had quite an arrest record over the course of his life.
But for fraud.
But for fraud and theft. And he was always getting either a few months in jail or probation or something like that. And I think he just thought, this is just another thing.
I'll pull the wool over on them.
Yep.
Until you went to that property in Lacine.
Until we went to the property in Lacine.
Are the three remaining women that we know of who have not been found, are those considered open cases?
Yes.
What are your thoughts about the possibility that someday you will find some sort, I hate the word closure, but some sort of answers for those families?
So in a sense, they're open because they've not been found, but he was convicted of their deaths. I don't know. I mean, I think everybody has their own opinion of where they might be. But as I said before, he evolved over time. So for example, the barrels that we found in Raymore, they were just regular 55-gallon barrels. And we know that at one point in time, they started to rust through as the people were decomposing.
Yeah.
So there was complaints made to management there, and they contacted Robbins, and he said, oh, it's probably a dead raccoon or something. And he went in and wrapped them up and this, that, and the other. The women that we found in Lacine, they were in hazmat barrels that weren't going to rust or anything like that.
Had you not found those, would we ever know the fate of those women?
Probably not. I mean, maybe eventually somewhere down the road, but I don't think so. And I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that there are more people out there, as you had said previously. And I think if you talk to any of the investigators, they all feel the same way.
Did his attorneys give you any ideas about just why? I mean, not that you can pick through the brain of someone who is a sociopath, but why?
Well, the attorneys didn't tell us, but I think that it was pretty clear as you investigated this case. And like I had said at the break, there's so much information. I mean, we could have a discussion for 8-10 hours about
this.
You
said the death penalty squad even said to him, we cannot get you out of this.
Right.
This is airtight. You are not getting out.
Yes. We did a great job on the whole investigative team did. But I think that, in my opinion, I think everybody that you would talk to, it wasn't so much that he necessarily wanted to, or felt the need to kill these women, because we know that he had been with so many different people over the years. I think these were people that maybe were putting pressure on him for different things.
Yeah. You said you were going to do this for me. And you said you were going to do this.
In a way, it was kind of the cost of doing business with him. I mean, that sounds cold and callous, but that's kind of the best way to summarize it.
Do we know, were there ever any women who escaped? Anyone that you were able to contact who said, I did go stay with him and I lived to tell about it?
Absolutely. And we know that there was one. He had a long-term relationship with her on and off. He told her, he said, hey, I've got a place down on the scene. I'd like to move you there. Mm-hmm. It'll be a place for you, because at one time she was homeless. She's like, I'm in. He said, all right, meet me at the hotel in Olathe. So they spent the night together. And she told us that that night was the first night he'd ever spent the night with her. And she said she was so excited for the move the next day. She got up really early in the morning and took a shower and got ready. And when she came out from the shower, he was dressed, sitting on the edge of the bed, and she said he was furious. And he said, you ruined everything. Got up, and that was the last time she saw him. He left.
He let her go, essentially.
Well, I think he was going to take her down there and do the same thing to her. And she kind of spoiled it by trying to be, you know, excited about moving down there. And she actually came forward with her attorney and asked us, or told us, she'd like to tell us her story.
Wow. So you have given talks about this case across the country. You said one of the conferences, it was like an 8-hour discussion of this. What has come from this for law enforcement? For like how, because this was one of the first internet adjacent crimes, and what are you able to teach other law enforcement officers about it?
I think what maybe what helped to talk with the talks was it gave them some direction maybe in cases that are similar. I know we were getting calls during the investigation. We got one from Moscow. We got them from Europe, all over the United States. You know, we found a barrel and had a body in it and things like that. But I think more so, it was right at the beginning of the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet was
for law enforcement
place.
Too, you said.
Right. Yeah. And so I think what it did, it gave law enforcement another tool or another avenue that they had to explore. And so now you see these huge
like cyber crimes units,
yes,
and stuff.
Yes.
That didn't exist when this all first broke. You said you had two computers.
We had two forensic computers, and it took days to download what the FBI can do now, the HIDTA unit, they can do now in a couple hours.
Wow.
And I think that it's really helped with the internet porn, with child porn.
Absolutely. And cracking some of that. And we're seeing new laws about that, by the way, in, yes, the AI space.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime in Real Time roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WWJ News Radio in Detroit, KNX News in Los Angeles, WBBM News Radio in Chicago, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, KMOX in St. Louis, 1010 Winds in New York, and the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.